Blog Talk Radio. It is just a few days after Christmas, and so I thank you if you are joining in. This is In the Middle with Ashley Moss. Typically, we stream live on Mondays, every Monday. We're brought to you by Texas Metro News, of course, but also Wells Fargo. If you go to texasmetronews.com, click on the Wells Fargo ad, you could win your own special iMessenger t-shirt or a business card ad for 3 months. A quick reminder, you can check out Texas Metro News on social media. Our handle is the same. It's easy to find all across platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can go to @TexasMetroNews. This vital news coverage that we offer all across our platforms is made possible by supporters just like you. We invite you to like, share, and subscribe to our content. Or you can find our handle again on social media at Texas Metro News. And while you're at it, if you find value in today's show, you can subscribe to our daily e-blast. Visit TexasMetroNews.com to sign up, or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Be sure to tune in every Monday at 11 a.m. Central Time, where we're talking about topics that matter. Well, good morning. Again, my name is Ashley Moss, host of In the Middle, and today we have a very special show for you. Our programming, if you might notice all throughout the week, there's a little bit of a switch up just because it is a holiday week and we're gearing up for a most likely very busy and prosperous new year. But I just wanted to get on today because we have still, obviously, the news does not stop even when we do. And so we have the opportunity today to have a conversation around the Young Black Lawyers Organizing Coalition. So I'm actually just going to go ahead and we're going to get right into it today to maximize time. And I'm going to add our host, Abdul Dasunmu, to the stream. Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you join, and you're going to have to kind of help us here in Texas because we're going to talk a lot about Georgia and voter protection and voter rights, but you're going to have to help us here in Texas to understand why that matters here specifically. So why don't you just go ahead and explain who you are, what you do, why we should care?
Absolutely. Well, I am the founder and chief strategist of the Young Black Lawyers Organizing Coalition. We are a network of young Black lawyers and law students who have come together to help protect and safeguard Black voting rights. And, you know, we could not think of a better way to leverage our legal training on behalf of our communities, particularly in this election year that is so critical to the issues that our communities have been activating around forever, but especially this year. And so we came together earlier this year in South Carolina during the presidential primary there, which has a particularly large and influential Black voting population. And we really started to do some work on the ground in partnership with communities in Columbia, South Carolina, Richland County. And what we've discovered over the course of that work is that about 94,000 Black voters in South Carolina are on the inactive rolls, which means that they are at risk of voter suppression when they go to vote. And so we partnered with local institutions, faith-based communities, small Black businesses, civic associations, and other stakeholders to really get the message out to as many Black voters as we can about the importance of continuously monitoring your voter registration status, and generally just knowing what you're entitled to as a voter when you go to vote, knowing your rights. Because if you know your rights, you can stand confident in those rights when there are attempts to undermine them. And we reached about 3,000 Black South Carolinians through that effort in partnership with local institutions, and really carried that vision forward of community-centered voter education, of leveraging our skills to support impact litigation in critical areas. And all of that came together around our Black Ballots, Black Futures campaign during the November elections. Somehow, we had about 7 target states in this election, including Texas, where I'm from and where I am right now. And so I'm somebody who can speak directly to the issues that are happening here in Texas around, unfortunately, around voter suppression and around efforts to undermine an inclusive democracy. But we were active across the country, and here's I think the core animating point. Black voters are critical to the advancement of this country, to the advancement of this democracy, and dealing with issues of equity and opportunity are central to the future of this country. And yet, there are robust efforts across the country to undermine inclusive democracy and to stifle the voice of Black voters.
Did we lose you?
Oh no, did you lose me? Am I still there?
You're there. There you go.
I'm sorry about that. I don't know what happened. But we've seen a rise over the course of the last several years since the Shelby County Beholder decision in 2013 in voter suppression laws across the country. And so the landscape that Black voters face today is one that is rife with any number of voter suppression tactics, from closing polling locations and concentrating those closures in communities of color, to tech malfunctions, to late openings. We saw dozens of late openings across the state of Texas, for instance. So, you asked about the relevance to us Texans. The relevance is that we're all kind of stitched together in this reality, this unfortunate reality of voter suppression. And what we're doing as young Black lawyers is trying to take a bottom-up, community-up, community-centered approach to empowering Black voters to resist and overcome that voter suppression.
Let's backtrack for a second, because I want to make sure, I don't want to assume that our audience understands some of the key terms that you've referred to. From your perspective, how do you define voter suppression?
Absolutely. So voter suppression, very simply, are laws and policies and rhetoric aimed at discouraging, disqualifying, or denying your right to vote. And I think each part of that definition is critical for us to understand. That sometimes we'll talk about the disqualifying and the denying, but we won't talk about the discouraging. And I think it's important for us to see all of them as part and parcel of an attempt to undermine access. But it's also important for us to take a step back and understand that there's a historical legacy here. unfortunately. And that we have never, I like to say, if we succeed in this generation in building an inclusive democracy in this country, it will be the first time that we have seen that in this country, because we have never really had a truly inclusive democracy. And part of the Black freedom struggle in this country has always been centered around demanding our right to vote and demanding our right to leverage our hopes and dreams in the conversations around a policy in this country. And so it's important for us to understand that there is a historical legacy, but that historical legacy is manifesting itself in new ways in the 21st century since the Shelby County Beholder decision. And let me tell you what that decision.
Come back. Well, when you do join us again, Abdul, I think we'll hit a pause. Let me take a break, and we'll come right back and talk about that Shelby v. Holder decision. So we're just going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And we're back. So Abdul, you were telling us about the Shelby Holder decision.
Yes, the Shelby County v. Holder decision is an important one for your audience to understand. So, as I mentioned, part of the Black freedom struggle has always been connected to ensuring inclusive democracy and fighting for our right to vote. And as a result of that struggle, during the 1960s, of course, we see the Voting Rights Act. And what the Voting Rights Act does is it creates what's called a preclearance requirement for states that had a history and legacy of voter suppression. So a history and legacy of those laws and policies that I talked about before the break. And what that preclearance requirement said to those states is that before you make any changes to your voting laws and policies, because you have this history, you actually have to get approval from the federal Justice Department. The idea being that if there is a check and balance on those states, that you're less likely to see the kinds of discriminatory laws emerge and be successful. And so what we saw really for the last 50 or so years was the emergence of a preclearance regime that required states, before they made any changes, before you changed any polling place location, before you changed, you know, your early voting hours, you actually had to go to the Federal Justice Department to get approval. Shelby County v. Holder comes along in 2013, and a conservative Supreme Court says, well, actually, we don't think discrimination in voting is a problem anymore. We have a pretty inclusive democracy. These issues that you've been fighting for forever are pretty much moot, and they're no longer relevant. And so we don't need that preclearance requirement anymore. And so that conservative Supreme Court in 2013 eviscerates the Voting Rights Act. So when you hear people talking about the importance of reviving and renewing the Voting Rights Act, what they're really talking about is the importance of reinstating that preclearance requirement on states. Because what we saw right after that decision is states, including Texas, start to make rapid changes to their voting laws and policies almost overnight. Almost overnight, we saw the emergence of voter ID laws. And those voter ID laws often would center on identification, class-based identification. So, you know, you could vote with your driver's license. Not everybody drives. Or you could vote with, in Texas, or in some states, you could vote with your gun license, but not with your student ID. And so we saw the rise of laws that, quite frankly, you could literally map the impact on communities of color. I worked at the U.S. Department of Transportation before law school during the Obama era. And one of the issues that we saw toward the end of my time at USDOT is that the state of Alabama, for instance, decided they had a voter ID law, and then they decided to close, a good number of DMV locations. And a lot of those closures were centered on Black and Brown communities in Alabama. And so you can see the direct effect between the voter ID laws and Black communities. And we're sitting in that legacy right now.
Let me pause here. What was the explanation for closing in those neighborhoods? Because there's always some type of explanation, right? No one's ever going to come out and say, Black and Brown communities, we're just going to close them here. What was the reasoning behind that?
So, typically what you will hear from elections officials is that they don't have resources or those sites don't have the usership. And so typically they will make a resource argument and the usership argument is really essentially a resource argument. But what I think is important for us to understand is that, first of all, rarely does the data actually bear that out. You will find that the polling sites that people say are closed or the DMV locations are actually among the highest used in the state. But beyond that, resource allocation decisions almost always somehow come down on the side of closing polling sites and locations in our communities. And I think that's important for your audience to know, because voters actually have the ability to hold elections officials accountable to those decisions. And I think if I had one core message today, separate and apart from our work in Georgia, it would be to know who your local elections administrators are. Know how they are selected or appointed or elected, and make sure that you have a route to holding them accountable. So here in Dallas County, where I am, the elections administrator is selected by the county commissioners. It's important for you to know who that person is, to know who's making those decisions, and to know what the budget is of those offices. So I went last night and looked at some of the budget numbers here in Dallas County. You can do that. That information is online, so that ultimately they know you're paying attention to the decisions they're making. I want to encourage us to be active participants, not just in democracy on the back end, but on the front end too, in terms of the administration of elections and making sure that they are equitable for our communities.
And I'm backtracking here. You keep mentioning democracy, and I have had people more than one tell me recently, democracy is a pipe dream. Democracy is a term that you hear about. It's a term that you read about, but it's not actually, what does that even mean in 2020 in the United States? So from your perspective, break that down for us. What does that even look like?
Right. Well, I do think it's important for us as young lawyers who are doing this work to take a step back. And to understand that there is tremendous skepticism in particular about electoral politics. Because people look at electoral politics and they say it's rife with, the influence of big money. It's never really been truly responsive to the issues and concerns of Black communities. So why should I bother? Why should I participate? And I think the one answer that I always give to that is, number one, at the end of the day, the revolution might not be televised, but it will have to be legislated and it will have to be enacted and it will have to be signed into law. And the question is whether you are at that table or not. But the table itself is going to exist. And the policies and laws are going to impact you at the end of the day. But to your broader question around what is democracy and what does it mean? And what does it mean for us? You know, I think at the end of the day, it's the ability to express your hopes and dreams for this country and to have them respected. And, you know, we, as I've said, we have a history, unfortunately, of not having our hopes and dreams as people of color respected in this country. But we also have a history of fighting to ensure that they are. And so what does you know, democracy look like? You know, I think it is a complicated reality that there are forces that believe in limited voice and limited democracy. You know, but they are always juxtaposed with and put into conversation with and challenged by those of us who believe in broad, inclusive democracy. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, our history as a country is the history of both of those forces. And, you know, I think what we have to do is make sure that we're accountable to the legacy that was passed on to us by our ancestors, that we're continuing to fight for our seat at the table. Mm-hmm. And to fight to ensure that the side of inclusive democracy wins.
Mm-hmm. And so in that accountability, or let's go back to the point that you made, particularly mentioning you're in Dallas County, knowing who your elections officials are, what else is, as everyday citizens and everyday Americans, what is our accountability? What do we need to be responsible for?
Well, first and foremost, vote. Start there. It is,
And not just every four years.
Absolutely. Vote in your local elections, vote for municipal offices, vote for school board, vote the entire ballot. And it's, you know, it's important for you to understand that it all works together. It all fits together. And so a lot of times when I hear people talk about, you know, the limited impact of democracy and it doesn't really make a difference, they are thinking most generally about Washington politics. And Washington politics has some issues, some real issues, and we have to do what we can to create a reform movement to address those issues. Those issues are, some are inherent to electoral politics, and then some are inherent to kind of media culture, inherent to kind of the way we live our lives in silos in the 21st century. And so what they're pointing to is the seeming inability of Washington to do anything, right? And we've seen that with kind of the stimulus conversations over the past few weeks in particular. But I think it's important for us to accept and embrace that democracy demands that we participate at every level. Mm-hmm. So vote. And I recognize that is not easy for people to do. Mm-hmm. So I'm not somebody who is interested in, you know, offering just quick and easy cliches to, you know, what we ought to do, because voting is not something that everybody is easily empowered to do. So what I would encourage you to do is know your rights. Make sure that you are aware of what, you know, obligations elections officials have to you when you step into the polling place or when you mail in your absentee ballot. Make sure that you know you have the right to vote free of racial discrimination. Make sure you have the right, make sure you know you have the right to request assistance if you need it. Make sure you know you have the right to vote if you're in line by 7 o'clock or whenever the polls close in your jurisdiction. Make sure you have a basic grasp of those rights, because if you know them, no one can take them away from you.
While we're waiting for Abdul, he's breaking down kind of what we can do as citizens to make sure that we're empowered at the polls and after. Please continue.
Absolutely. So the second thing that I would encourage people to do, in addition to voting, is making sure that, number one, you're checking your voter registration status all the time. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly important in an era of voter suppression where we're seeing voter purging. across the country. Let me break down what voter purging is. Mm-hmm. Voter purging is the phenomenon where an elections board will decide, because you haven't voted in two general election cycles usually, that you are quote unquote an inactive voter, and they will remove you from the rolls. And operating right now, Georgia is really battleground for voter purging. So it's important that one of the ways that you can combat that is to make sure you're continuously checking your voter registration status. And usually your elections officials, your local elections board, has some mechanism, online mechanism, by which you can go in and double check your voter registration status. See when you're registered, see that you're active. So we encourage people to take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. We also encourage, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, no, please continue, because I think my next question is, we're, and we're going to get to the conversation about what's happening in Georgia, but we're after the polls essentially, right? And so if you have anything in particular that you want to share about what happened here in Texas, I invite you to do that. But after the polls, other than checking that voter registration status, making sure you're up to date, keeping track of what's happening, what are we supposed to be doing after the polls until the next midterm election or general election? And I, for folks that are, you know, I talked to several folks on election day who said, I'm not really concerned about what's happening in my community. I may or may not come out to the next general election, depending on what happens with whoever is in office for the next 4 years.
Well, that is a very real sentiment. We confronted it quite a bit in November. What I would say is, it just isn't true that you're not concerned, right? You know, at root, you are concerned. You are concerned about what happens with schools in your community. You do care whether or not there's stimulus support for small Black businesses. You are invested in making sure, at the simplest level, that your neighborhood is well taken care of, right? And that, you know, when you go to, you know, apply for a bank loan, that you get access, right? These are daily life issues that I think all of us are invested in. And so, it's important for us to sometimes separate our frustration with the electoral political project in this country and how it has manifested itself with ultimately our right and our need to be involved in the process of making that democracy more accountable. Mm-hmm. So I think there, you know, those are two conversations that I think we've got to continue to elevate our fluency in, because it is possible to be frustrated with our politics, but also engaged in trying to change it. And that's what I would encourage people to do. I would encourage you to understand, what are the issues in your local community? Who's fighting for those issues? Who's on the front lines? And then do what you can to get behind those folks and try to empower them. So, you know, make sure that you're paying attention to what's happening in your local community. Even if you're frustrated with what's happening in Washington, and I would encourage you not to disengage from that, make sure you are engaged in what's happening in your local community. And then I would say, beyond that, we need a real movement for a more robust democracy. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the conversation around democratic reform in this country tends to focus on sort of small bore measures. But I do think it's important for us to understand that right now there are millions of folks who are disenfranchised because of a felony conviction. We need to do everything we can, and this is an issue that we're going to be working on as an organization moving forward, to try to empower those individuals to be full participants in our democracy and to try to remove the barriers that inhibit that today. So we have a responsibility to do that. We have a responsibility to make it easier to vote, not harder to vote. I mean, the truth of the matter is, there are other democracy. We call ourselves a beacon of democracy, but there are other nations around the world that have much easier, much more efficient voting practices. We ask people to, you know, somehow find time to go to the polls, usually before they go to work or after they get off of work, to stand in line, to deal with inefficiencies, to deal with polling places that aren't open and when they're supposed to be open, to deal with machines that are breaking down. And we need a real movement in this country to make it easier than that to vote. So what does that look like? Some states have automatic voter registration so that when you, you know, graduate or when you get your driver's license, you're automatically registered to vote. And it's an opt-out system as opposed to an opt-in system. Right now, most states have an opt-in where, you know, you've got to decide, I want to be a voter and I want to participate. But it could be another way. It doesn't have to be that way. It could be an opt-out system where you're automatically registered to vote and you just you can decide if you want to opt out, right? That's a movement that everyday individuals in their communities can really start to push for, you know, and so I think it's important for us to sort of keep our eye on some of those big picture items that can really transform the experience of voting. We mentioned resource allocation. I want to make sure that every individual, again, knows who your local elections stakeholders are, because you can be holding them accountable. Mm-hmm. Because even if they are not elected, they are appointed and selected by somebody who is elected. And you have the ability to make sure that your concerns are addressed. The final area that I would really encourage people to engage in around this is if you have the ability, if you have the capacity, actually sign up to be an elections worker. Sign up to work the polls in your communities. We saw a big push around this year because of the pandemic. But anybody who's gone to vote knows that typically the election workforce tends to be older. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons we saw the big push this year is that we wanted to keep high risk individuals out of harm's way. And so we tried to recruit younger folks. We signed up some folks as Y Block and other organizations, really tried to drive this. But I think it would be helpful for all of us to find a way to participate in the administration of elections in our local communities. Mm-hmm. Because then you get a sense of what are the challenges, what are the barriers to access, what are the issues, what are the problems. But you also are in the space and you can start to mitigate some of the problems for voters. You know, and so I think that would be great. The other thing that does is it actually minimizes the, you know, the resource argument, which is that, oh, we don't have enough folks to work the polls in this precinct, so we've got to close it. You know, so if we're all signing up to do our part, I think we can really move this conversation forward.
Can I backtrack just a bit? Because I want to make sure that we're constantly making the concepts easy to understand. Can you backtrack and explain again what the barriers to access are? One thing that you brought up earlier in our conversation that I thought is pretty astounding is the concept of like racial inequity at the polls, or just flat out racism. And sometimes I feel like in communities where we're so entrenched in that, you forget what it looks like, or you don't know what it looks like. So can you break that down for us?
Absolutely. So, and this is one of the things we do in our voter protection training sessions across the country. So, you know, I'll give you one case in point. We have already mentioned it, but polling place closures. There was a report by the Leadership Conference for Civil Rights a few years ago that identified, I think it was something like 700 closures, polling closures, right here in the state of Texas over the course of several years. The majority of those concentrated in Black and brown communities. That's voter suppression. We saw the Texas Civil Rights Project is a partner of ours, and they do tremendous work. They released some data earlier this year. Now, this was before November, so I'm not sure if they've updated these numbers since November. But before November, during the runoffs, during the primaries, earlier this year in Texas, we saw 53 late openings.
Wow.
Meaning you got to the polls at the advertised time and they weren't open. Right? That is voter suppression. So I think it's important for us to understand that voter suppression can look like either of those two things, right? It can look like the active decision to close the poll in a black or brown community. And again, the issue there, some people say, well, the intent is not voter suppression. Well, but the effect is, right? Because you're concentrating these closures in communities of color and limiting black and brown political voice. But it can also look like the second, which I think most people would see as more operational failure than anything else. But operational failure, especially when that failure, again, is concentrated in black and brown communities, is voter suppression. Long lines is another one that I talked a lot about during the November elections. Many of us saw those long lines as two sides of one coin. On one side of the coin, you say, oh, isn't it great to see people participating? It's great to see people active and engaged in our democracy and excited about, democratic possibility. But on the other hand, standing in a long line, you shouldn't have to.
Yeah.
And then those long lines don't exist everywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, just visually take yourself back to November and look at the images of the long lines you saw. And ask yourself who you saw in those lines and why, right? That's voter suppression. And so, you should know how it looks. When machines break down and there isn't the kind of technological infrastructure in place to really support functioning machines, efficiently functioning machines, that's voter suppression. So it can look like, what we've seen throughout our history, which is the active effort to deny our vote. And it can also look like a more passive operational failure. But they both function in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And often when you peel back the layers on that operational failure, what you will find is that it's not that way everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's important, I think, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to kind of walk through that, because these are real issues that voters are confronting. I mean, we were hearing from voters every day. Our lawyers were working the 866 Our Vote hotline, which is a number that I hope your audience will get accustomed to, 866 Our Vote, 866-687-8683. We were getting 7,000 calls a day.
Wow.
On average. In the run-up to the November elections. And that number obviously was multiplied, many times over on election day itself. And so, these are issues that people are confronting in their communities. It's important for them to know that it's voter suppression when they see it.
And to that end, you all are holding a training tonight, correct? Is that related to voter protection?
Yes, we are. And yes, it is. So Georgia, as I mentioned, Georgia has this hotly contested slate of runoff elections on Tuesday, January 5th. And essentially, the United States Senate hangs in the balance. And we're a nonpartisan organization. We don't have, we're not trying to dictate outcomes. We just want to make sure that people are able to participate in the process. But there is a very important Senate election happening, and black folks have a real stake in the outcome of that election. And
because
the Senate plays a key role in policy change for our community. So if you are concerned about COVID relief, if you are concerned about stimulus, if you looked at the $600 stimulus check yesterday and said, how is this supposed to help anybody? This needs to be much more robust. Some countries are doing this monthly. Why is the United States only doing a $600 stimulus? If you're looking at that and saying that, you need to be invested in these Senate elections. You know, if you care about student loan forgiveness, if you care about criminal reform of the criminal legal system, if you care about healthcare, these are all issues that you literally cannot make progress on without the United States Senate. Can you hear me?
You're back.
Okay. It is not enough to say, oh, well, we voted for the president and we're done. Because the president is part of a system. And that system includes the Senate and the House. It includes the judiciary, which is an issue we don't even have probably time enough to talk about. But, you know, we've seen the judiciary stacked over the course of the last several years toward conservative justices. And so, you know, if you're concerned about reproductive rights, if you're concerned about affirmative action, that all runs through the courts, which, again, all runs through the Senate and the White House. So we have a stake in that. And yet, Georgia is one of these states where we have seen robust efforts around voter suppression. We've seen voter purging. Many people know the name Stacey Abrams. Stacey Abrams has been working on these issues for a long time. Her own gubernatorial race was impacted, many would say, by some of these issues. Georgia is a hotbed of voter suppression. And so what we've done, and in coordination with a lot of other groups, is we have said, you know, we've got to actually get the word out to folks. We've got to do what we can to empower voters to know their rights, to be able to navigate around voter suppression and resist it. And so we're hosting sessions. We've been hosting sessions, and we have our final training session today at 3 Eastern. If you're interested in attending, you can go to yblock.org. Even if you're not a Georgia voter, you just are generally interested in Georgia issues. Maybe you know voters in Georgia, you know, or you're just generally interested in more information about some of the issues we've been talking about, I would encourage you to attend that session. And we're doing everything we can in partnership with Black Radio, partnership with community organizations to really get the word out to folks about their rights, because this election is so critical.
What else do we need to know? Anything?
Well, know that you have the power. Mm-hmm. Know that you have the power. One of the things we always emphasize at the end of all of our sessions is the goal of this information is not to discourage you. The goal of telling you about voter suppression is not to get you to say, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. The goal is to actually make sure that, number one, you know what the issues are so that when you confront them, you can respond to them. But number two, the goal is to make sure that you know one thing, and that is that your voice and your vote are powerful. So powerful, in fact, that there are forces that are spending millions, if not billions of dollars to try to undermine it. And if you know you have that powerful a tool in your hands, you've got to do everything you can to use it and protect it. Mm-hmm. And so I just would encourage people to make sure you're using your vote and you're protecting your vote. Mm-hmm.
I love you've emphasized so many things today. So for someone who they're listening to our conversation, they are encouraged, they are empowered, they want to stay on top of things. What types of tools and resources should we be leaning on to make sure we get the right information that's timely and not inaccurate?
That is such a critical question. So one of the things that we saw here in Texas was quite a bit of misinformation during the election. And I think it's important for people to understand that you don't have to be, you know, misinformation gets spread a variety of ways. And it doesn't have to be intentional. But it still has the same effect. So someone sent me a text that they had received from a fellow church member of theirs who thought she was doing the right thing. She saw something on Facebook and she sent it around. And before I knew it, I was getting calls from multiple faith leaders in Dallas about this one text. And so it's important for us to understand the importance of engaging, reliable, accurate information. So what I would encourage you to do is know who some reliable partners and sources of information are. So you know that if you come to Texas Metro News, you're going to get reliable information. You know that if you're reading it generally reading in a mainstream publication, you're going to get reliable news. You know that if you're getting it from a trusted civil rights partner, you're going to get reliable news. I would encourage you to become familiar with the following organizations. Become familiar with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Become familiar with the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Familiarize yourself with, wonderful. I see the list up on the screen. Familiarize yourself with some of these organizations. Texas Civil Rights Project, if you're here in Texas. And of course, we are a newer organization, but we're hoping to become a resource for folks, an ongoing resource for people as well. So you can continue to follow us, but make sure that you know who some trusted partners are for information, so that as you're making decisions and certainly as you're sharing information with your community, that you're sharing the right information. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I would start with that. And then just make sure you're double checking. Make sure that you don't take anybody's word as the gospel truth. You know, make sure that when you see something on social media, you go and check it in one of those reliable publications or with one of those reliable partners. Again, that hotline is a very useful resource, 866-OUR-VOTE. They're a partner of ours in our work. So we encourage you to call that number. You can call that number if you have any issues. So if you get prepared to vote and you discover that, you know, you don't know what kind of voter ID you need.
So we'll be right back. About resources that you can utilize to make sure that you have the right information, how you can eliminate misinformation.
Absolutely. And then that hotline is so critical because you can call them with everything from a small issue like what kind of voter ID do I need to a large systemic issue like I got to my polling place and it wasn't open. What can I do? What do you do? Voter intimidation has been an issue in this election season. And one of the things that we're seeing in Georgia right now are robust voter challenges. Unfortunately, we've seen even an organization based in Texas try to challenge voters in Georgia. I mean, it's just been really, really insane, some of what we've seen in this election. And so if you are at the polls and somebody is challenging your vote and you know you have the right to vote, or if you're at the polls and you are experiencing some form of intimidation, whether it's violent intimidation or nonviolent intimidation, you can call that number and that will activate a systemic response, whether that's a court filing or whatever the issue might be. We encourage you to call that number as a first resort, to make sure that you are reporting those issues in, because we can mobilize as a community around that. So that hotline number is very, very important. Thank you for amplifying it.
And for those of us who you're here in Texas, you're somewhere across the country, how can we support our neighbors in Georgia leading up to the election? I've heard of people saying, we're going to get a caravan and we're going to drive out there and we're going to be ready in the streets. Is that the best thing that we can do?
They're probably not. I think one of the things that we heard quite consistently from our partners on the ground is that you really want to be thoughtful about how you engage, because there's another side that is looking to weaponize any little thing against voters and Black voters in the state. And so you want to be thoughtful about how you engage. So what I would encourage you to do is, again, to identify some of those trusted partners. Fairfight is a great organization doing great work in Georgia. New Georgia Project. You know, there are a host of nonpartisan organizations that are doing really good work on the ground, that have been doing good work on the ground for a long time. And one way to get involved is to volunteer. You can volunteer from right where you are to make phone calls. You know, and especially in this COVID environment that we're in, COVID-19, I would not encourage you to hop in a van and go to Georgia. I just stay where you are and make calls from the comfort of your home. Obviously, if you're in a position to support the work of organizations that are on the ground doing this, financially support those organizations, consider doing that. You know, make sure you're if you're amplifying on your social platforms, again, make sure you're amplifying accurate and reliable information. And then if you know folks in Georgia, if, you know, everybody knows somebody in Georgia. If you know somebody in Georgia, make sure they're voting. Make sure they have a plan to vote. Some of the most impactful work you can do in this space is actually work that you do in your family and in your sphere of influence. So if you know somebody in Atlanta, the metro area, Augusta, Columbus, wherever they are across the state, make sure that you are reaching out to them. Make sure they know about the January 5th runoff elections and make sure they have a plan to vote. And if they have questions about it, hopefully you've been empowered during this conversation to actually answer some of those questions or direct them to the right resources.
And before we end our time today, I would be remiss if I did not ask you about your personal story. What drew you to this important topic? How did you get here? You've also were involved, I believe, with the Obama administration. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for asking. I actually grew up in Dallas. Was born in on the East Coast in the DMV. fellow DMVer. But my family has pretty deep roots here in Texas, particularly on my maternal side. My father is, my late father was an immigrant to this country from Nigeria, and my mom is a multi-generational Texan. I was raised largely by my mom here in Dallas. Our family owned a restaurant for about 50 years in the Oak Cliff neighborhood called in South Dallas Fair Park, and then later in Oak Cliff, called Harold's Catfish and Shrimp. I grew up literally in that restaurant, and I think that's really where kind of I got bitten by the bug of civic engagement, because as much as our restaurant was, a place to get a good plate of catfish, it was also a place to have a lot of these kinds of community conversations, and they were very, very robust. And we, you know, would often have community leaders come in and politicians and the like. And so I was just exposed to that at a very early age motivated to really get involved. Went to high school at the School for the Talented and Gifted here in Dallas at Townview. Graduated, went to the University of Chicago for undergrad. Got involved in Chicago politics. Doing community organizing work on the South Side, helping to bridge the divide between the University of Chicago, which is wealthy and, you know, has all this great privilege and resource, and its surrounding community. And there was often a power imbalance between those two. I got involved in some of the work to bridge the divide there. And that really was my springboard into the work that I'm doing today, went forward. To work in the Obama administration in the transportation department. And one of the issues that we were focused on there was the issue of transportation equity. And so thinking about How transportation can either be a gateway to opportunity or a barrier to opportunity. And all too often, our communities have seen it and experienced it as a barrier to opportunity. So if you think about the conversations that we have around, you know, highways plowed right through Black and brown communities, you know, rail lines dissecting communities, that all of that was part and parcel of the work that I had the privilege of doing as an appointee to President Obama's at the Transportation Department.
Pausing right here. Abdul served as Special Assistant to the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, Anthony Fox, and advisors to the Department's Chief of Staff. Are you back?
I'm back. Thank you. So that was the work. I did that for toward the end of the Obama administration. And, you know, as I mentioned, have done a lot of work in equity spaces and thinking about how we leverage law and policy to create real opportunity, especially for community development. And so that's my passion. That's my animating passion. That's what led me to go to law school, went to law school at NYU School of Law, graduated into a global pandemic, 2020, earlier this year. But before I graduated, really felt like, okay, I've got a slate of experiences through political work and my community organizing work that I should be leveraging in some meaningful way in this election on behalf of our communities. And that really was the genesis of Y-Block. And a year later, year and some change later, I'm very proud of the impact that we've had. And, you know, I'm excited to continue this work moving forward. And the connection really is very simple. The equity and the opportunity that I believe we all want to see for our communities runs through democracy. And so, you know, to me, there's a very clear through line in the work that I've done and hopefully the work that I will continue to do.
Anything else you'd like to share?
You know, I'm just grateful to all of our supporters, grateful to everybody who's worked with us. We had some really great partners on the ground, especially here in Texas. One of our big initiatives was to get PPE to Black voters during the election. We got about 180,000 pieces of PPE out. Most of that here in Texas and in South Carolina, some a bit in Georgia. And we had some great community partners in that work. And I just want to, you know, extend my gratitude to all the folks who have worked so willingly with us. And we look forward to being around for quite a while.
Wonderful. And so for folks that want to keep up with what you're doing, get in touch with you, what can they do?
So first thing is familiarize yourself with our website, yblock.org. Check that out. We've got some good information there, good resources. You can follow us on all social platforms at Young Black Lawyers. And it's usually it's Young BLK Lawyers on all the social platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you can follow me on Twitter at underscore @ADOSUNMU.
All right. I send that in the chat. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time. So again, we'll have that information that you need in the chat. We'll also have it up on TexasMetroNews.com probably later this week and also on our Facebook page. But again, an important conversation. I'm going to go ahead and leave this website up for the Young Black Lawyers Organizing Coalition. Important conversation, and this is really just a companion to the conversation that we continue to have here, which is to get involved and stay involved at a local level, right? And so don't get discouraged by what you're seeing on the screens, what you're seeing in Washington. Get involved at the local level so that you can make an impact wherever you are. And so valuable information that Abdul shared today. If you're interested, go to this website, the YBOC website. There is a session tonight where the team will be talking more about voter protection efforts, what voter suppression is, and how you can, again, get involved on a local level and make a difference. And so, again, encourage you to stay in contact and involved with us. Thank you for joining us. Our show is a little bit shorter today, but this is a special edition bringing constant light to an important topic that we have going on here today. Voter suppression, information, empowerment, and advocacy, not only on Election Day, which was this past November, but moving forward. So again, thank you so much. Just want to go ahead and remind you guys in the Middle Streams Live every Monday at 11 a.m. Central Time with me. But we also have important, necessary programming all week long. We start off on Sundays with the gentleman, Andrew Wickham, who starts us off through the week. I'm here on Mondays. And then we have a team of committed, recognizable voices who are sharing valuable news and information in their own unique and special way. As a reminder, everything that we do comes as a result of Texas Metro News. And so I just invite you to like, share, and subscribe to our content. Going ahead, I'm going to leave this voter protection information up, as well as the Young Black Lawyers Organizing Coalition. Again, go to that website if you are interested at all in what they are doing tonight. Thank you again for joining us. We'll see you next week with a brand new show. Have a great week, and if I don't see you before then, Happy New Year.